Okay, well, thank you so much for submitting your questions. As you can see, we've got quite a pile. Diane and I have been trying to sort through things and kind of clump them together a little bit. There's no way we're going to be able to do them all, unfortunately, but there are many good questions. And at the end of the day, they all go home with Diane and inform her ongoing thinking and writing. So thank you, whether or not your question gets heard out loud here today. So Diane's going to come up and give us some preliminary odds and ends, and then we'll do some questions.
Diane feels like an odd and end. First of all, I thank you for the questions. You're clearly thinking and struggling and wondering and hurting and all kinds of things, and so I'm frankly honored to receive them. I'm going to answer about some categories first in terms of quite a few things that came together rather than just take individual questions. There were several questions about what to do with perpetrators or abusers in the church. And the first answer, which is not helpful at all but is true, is it depends. So it happens when you ask psychologists things, you know. But it does. If you have a sex offender in your church, he shouldn't be in your church. For several reasons, one of which you can't trust him. Two, if you let him come in the church and sit on the back row and have people guard him all the time and everything else, he's sitting on the back row looking at the children. So he's feeding his brain. That's not good for him either, obviously, and you don't want him feeding off your children. What many churches have started doing is what I call bringing the church to the offender. So I've known churches where we have a sex offender who's been convicted, maybe he's out of jail, whatever, waiting for court, and there's a small group in the church of adults, male and female, who meet with him once a week. They listen to the sermon, they sing, they pray, and they work with him. No kids anywhere. If he balks at that, that'll tell you something. We want to help everybody. You can't help everybody. And sex offenders are a very specialized thing. There are people who are highly trained to work with them, and that's who they need to see. There's a woman, a psychologist by the name of Anna Salter, who's done a lot of writing about sex offenders because that's been her life's work. And she's well worth reading, and she has videos that are wonderful for churches to look at where she's interviewing offenders in prison, and they'll start out sounding like these, you know, sweet guys who cut everybody's grass and helped all the old people and everything else, and then the flips to the later part of the interview and you find out they had 103 victims. So it's very educational. So there are things like that that you can do to educate yourselves, but you can't have sex offenders in your church. It's not okay. And it doesn't mean you don't love them and you don't want to see them repent and you won't work with them or walk with them or anything else, but they need the specialized treatment and all of that. Many years ago, there was a church that did have one, and he was doing everything they said, and they were letting him back in the church finally and all that kind of stuff, and it had been 2 or 3 years, and they all thought it was much better, and he disappeared one day, and nobody knew where he was, and he had flown to Thailand. And use your imagination. So that's number one. Two, a lot of you ask questions about victims and all the things they think about God, which are lies because of what's been done to them, and how do you help them? You don't tell them by telling them. Help them by telling them. Remember I told you about the woman who was trafficked by her father and all those things, and she was my teacher? I remember years ago with her, long time ago, trying to tell her what I knew was, and again, I was a baby at this, but what I knew was that if she really knew how much God loved her, it would change her life. So I tried telling her. And I referred to it as the splat effect. Tell, boing. Okay? That means it's not working. So I can vividly remember the day I got down on my knees by my bed, sometime the day before I was supposed to see her again, and I said, look, God, she needs to understand how much you love her. I don't know how to help her. I tried to tell her. She doesn't get it. And I know I'm PCA and I'm not supposed to say God told me, but God said. You want her to know? You want to know how? Well, you want her to know how much I love her? Then you get up off your knees, you go back in that office and you demonstrate it. And years later, probably 20 years later, I got a card from her. And she said, I remember when I first came to see you when you tried to tell me that God loved me and I had no idea what you were talking about. She said, you might as well have been trying to describe the color green to a blind person. Now you think about that. Somebody blind from birth, you want to tell them what green looks like. It's not happening. She said, but what you did was show me what love was, and now I know. So she was my teacher. The other thing I want to tell you, which I have told this story many times, and somebody here told this story to somebody else, so it's a victim's life bearing fruit she'll never know about till heaven. But this was a woman who was grew up in a rural area and was most of her late elementary school and all of her adolescent years taken out to the barn by cousins and everybody else, where they all stood in a circle around her and took turns gang raping her. And she had no idea that God cared anything about it. And she was full of shame. And, you know, how could she ever approach him? Because look at what she was. And I did something, hear me, which I only do much later in the work. Okay, so we'd worked on the abuse. We'd worked on its effects on her. We'd done skills and all kinds of things. She's told me the story. So we're talking a couple years down the road, maybe three. So I said to her, go home and read these three verses. It's in John. I don't remember the reference. I'm not good at that. But anyway, it's the part before the crucifixion. I didn't tell her anything about it. I said, just read these three verses. I want you to read them every day, three times, out loud. And all I want you to do is say, what do you want me to see here, God? Well, it was the part where it says the soldiers took his clothes. And she came back to my office the next week, and she comes through the door, and she's walking over to the couch, and she hasn't even sat down, and I haven't even closed the door. And she said, Diane, they took his clothes. They took his clothes. He knows. And that was the beginning of her loving, fruitful, prosperous relationship with Jesus Christ. She knew him. She was his child, but she couldn't get it in. That was what got it in. So again, you can't just say God loves you, he's faithful, and he was there, and all that kind of thing. And, you know, people will say, well, where was he when I was being abused? Well, he was there. Well, why didn't he stop it? I don't know. I can't answer that question for anybody. But eventually they see that he was there angry, weeping, and then they see what he went through. But that comes down the road, sometimes after years. Quoting scripture won't get God in. Living it out slowly over time will. And the other area is, many of you have asked questions about being in systems either as an abused person or somebody who's trying to help abuse people or clergy sexual abuse or whatever, and the system isn't listening to anything or doing anything. And you want to know what to do. And the other thing I often say is, I have no idea. I don't know what to tell you to do. I'm going to give you some thoughts. But sometimes we need to leave systems. But if you go on, if you Google my name, my website comes up. And if you do that, you'll see all kinds of videos and talks and things like that. I have a talk on systemic abuse, which will tell you a lot more about it than I did today. But remember that one of the things I said about it is it's hard to discern and very difficult to change. And so when you come up against a system, I mean, suppose you have a pastor who sexually abused some women in the congregation, and it comes to light, and everybody circles the wagon, and he really didn't do it, and he didn't mean it, and it was a mistake, and the force that you're coming up against is ridiculously strong. And you are the problem. So they want you to go away. So what I encourage people to do is to speak the truth and call them to the light. But there comes a point where you walk away because nobody's listening. And what you don't want to do is keep talking when nobody's listening, because every time you do that, they're hardening their hearts more. So you go away and you intercede. So you individually can't change a system, but you can speak truth to the powers that be, which is an invitation into the light. But if it is perpetually refused, no. And then lastly, full disclosure, I'm a board member for GRACE. I'm sure some of you know about GRACE, which stands for Godly Response to Abuse in a Christian Environment. It was started by Boz Chavijian, who's an attorney, was a prosecuting attorney in Florida many years ago, and he worked with sex offender cases, prosecuting them. So he had the experience for many years of going to court and seeing little girls and little boys and other people coming to testify against those who had abused them, and the church came to the court and sat on the side of the offender. So he decided maybe something needed to be done. So he started GRACE. And so it's been around for a while. It now has a seminary class course that can be used in seminaries. It now has a whole training and certificate program for churches. So they will come in and teach policies and procedures and thinking about this and how to respond and on and on and on. And then you get a certificate that says you took the course. And so you end up with educated leaders, educated church members, and all of that. So I would go, it's netgrace.org is the website. There's all kinds of resources up there. Justin Holcomb has written a book for children that's up there. Somebody asked about how to teach your children about abuse. There's a book there. That's a good little book. So I think you would find the resources very helpful, both personally and for your churches or institutions, in terms of things that you asked about. Okay. Now let's try other questions.
Okay. We've just knocked out about 32 of them.
Oh, good.
Okay. I think it is hard for women to seek help in the church because there are no examples of women in any form of authority. Women reach out to men who are often unable to understand, or in the case of this church, disregard the initial plea for help. How do churches run almost exclusively by men create authentic and effective resources for women? I just read the cards.
I'm not sure I like this arrangement. Well, might as well take some more risks, right? I don't think that a system like that can really, truly, effectively help women unless you learn from the women. Because unless... I had a daddy, I had a brother, I have a husband of 45 years, and I have two sons. I still don't know what it's like to be a man. Sometimes I think that's a good thing. But men don't have any idea what it's like to be a woman. That's okay. But that means you need to be informed by women. I have encouraged sessions. If you have a woman coming before a session for any reason, I don't care if it's to join the church, there should be other women in the room. You have no idea if this woman has an abuse history. She's going to come in and sit in front of 10 men? If you have a woman who's coming before leaders in the church, whether it's 1 or 12 or anything else, about domestic abuse, about a history of abuse, about a rape, about clergy sexual abuse, whatever, there should be women in the room. There should be women who advocate for them. There should be women who are educated about these things, and there should be men who are willing to be educated by the women. Good for you. There's a lot of men here. So I assume that's true for a lot of them. But I don't know where we got this idea. And I'm not talking about who's in charge and who's pastoring and who's preaching and all that kind of stuff. Leave all that out of it. I don't know where we got this idea that if you don't have any women around, you'll still know what to do. I mean, God made us this way. Male and female working together to bless his world. We really screwed the whole thing up, but that's still the design. And not only that, I think that's what we're going to do in heaven. We're actually going to work together. So we might as well start practicing. And to hear a woman tell you something and learn from her and change how you are is called humility. And the man that you follow is humble. And he sat with Samaritan women and prostitutes and all, and we're taught by him with these women. So we've done something really weird in the evangelical world. It's not just the evangelical world, but we've done something really weird about this thing. And it's making us stupid. Okay, we better stop me now.
Okay, let me give you, here are three related questions. I'll just give them all to you. How do you hold all of these stories without being crushed by them? How do you guard your own heart as you hear story after horrific story? And how do we keep from becoming cynical and suspicious of everyone around us, given the statistical certainty that there are hidden abusers in our churches and even in our circle of friends?
Well, first of all, there isn't a magic formula that I figured out, and now I don't have to do that anymore. That is a constant thing in my life. I have to constantly work with it. And as soon as I think I've got it okay for a while, I end up someplace like the Killing Fields of Cambodia, or talking to Rwanda genocide survivors, or having somebody come in and tell me a story about a Christian system that makes my brain hurt. And then I have to start all over again. So it's not a thing you learn how to do. I told somebody today, maybe it was Liam, but anyway, years ago, probably 25 years ago, so I've been doing this for 45 years. Anyway, I told God I was quitting. I didn't want to do it anymore. I don't like this. I'm living in a sewer. I don't like sewers. And he talked to me again. Get myself thrown out. Anyway. But my sense was, okay, Diane, sit down and make a list of the characteristics of what you do. Well, that was not too hard. It was ugly and evil and chaotic and hateful and abusive. And I mean, the list was long. And I held the list up. I said, see, this is why I don't want to do this anymore. And here's what he said. Write the opposite on the other side. Think of the opposite. That's where I want to live. Beauty, order, whatever. And all of a sudden I realized, that's him. He's beauty. He's order. He's lovely. Whatever. And I realized, it isn't just a spiritual thing, and this is a key point. It isn't just that he is these things, and that he gives these things to me in himself, which is all true and the central thing in my life. But he made a lot of things out there that I can see and touch and smell and hear that remind me of who he is. And those things are the antidote to what I do. So I deliberately seek out beauty and order and loveliness and all those things. I walk in the woods. I sit by the water. I learn about flowers and trees and birds and look at the stars. You think the world's chaotic? You listen to Bach. You go, huh, somebody wasn't chaotic. So I have things like that that I pursue. I have an office that has 15 other therapists in it who know and love Christ. And, you know, we sometimes practically crawl into each other's office and say, you're not going to believe what I heard. But we're there together. We pray for each other. We work together. So there's community, because you can't really go and have community at church about the things that you heard confidentially in your office. Not to mention, nobody would know what to do with the things I heard in my office. So you're limited. So you have to, and you have to learn to watch for the signs in yourself. When you start feeling like your clients, you're in trouble. You know, I remember years ago standing in church, and we were singing something, I don't know what, and all of a sudden I thought, you know, I wonder what they would do if they knew what was in my head. That's how a victim thinks. Or I was with two of my colleagues in Atlanta walking through the airport, and there was a father in front of us with a little girl who was probably 4 or 5, and she had the long blonde hair, and it was swinging, and he was holding her hand, and one of them said, "Isn't that a beautiful little girl?" And my first thought was, I wonder if he's abusing her. And I'm thinking, okay, Diane, you're in trouble. So you have to watch for those signs, but you have to deliberately seek out the antidotes to the poison that you're sitting with and consuming. And it's 45 years. So I guess something's okay. Either that or I'm really in trouble.
Okay, Diane, you wanted to speak to this one, to make the point clearer that same-sex clergy abuse happens in our churches.
Yes, we tend to think of that as a Catholic priest problem, which it is. But it is not just a Catholic priest problem. We have pastors, elders, leaders, teachers, professors, coaches, male, who abuse males. We have female leaders, teachers, part of our Christian organizations, whatever, who abuse females. Little ones and big ones, male and female. Nobody's exempt. So the idea that in our world only men abuse women is a lie. Men also abuse men and boys, and women abuse women and girls. The stats are different for those groups. But if you hear something that doesn't fit in the category you think is the only one, you're going to be in trouble. There's potential abusers in every category. And it's not just outside the Protestant world at all. So you need to make a file in your head for that.
Okay, again, I'm going to put these two together, both from women seeking to be helpful to other women. The first says, how can I, who am not a victim of abuse, be most helpful to my friend whose husband has been emotionally abusive for years? The second says, I'm an abuse survivor, not a counselor or leader. What can I do to help other women?
Well, if you're an abuse survivor, you do need to make sure that you've done your work. Because otherwise, you'll process it through your own abuse. And everybody's is different. So I would say that first. Secondly, you need to study. You know, I said, I think in the last session, that there are sometimes small groups of people in different churches, and they want to work with domestic abuse. So they, you know, read 6 or 8 books together, and they listen to things. And the same thing with sexual abuse. You need to read. You need to keep reading. You need to listen to videos online and all of that. Because if you do not understand some of the things we talked about today and way more than that, you will inadvertently hurt wounded people. And which is exactly what you don't want to do. So, and the other thing which I tell therapists all the time is, and I tell myself, it doesn't matter how many abuse victims you've seen, and I have no idea how many I've seen, everybody's different. Every story is different. Every personality is different. The way it was processed is different. What happened afterwards is different. You never see the same thing twice. So no matter how much you do and how much you see and how much you read, somebody walks in and says, I'm being abused, you don't know. You have to start with, I don't know what it's like to be this person in this place with this abuse. So I would love to see the church raise up more and more educated, knowledgeable caregivers in these areas, male and female. I think that's who we're supposed to be. And I think that's the only way to do this work and not be unsafe.
Okay, I think you just glanced on this one. Let me see if you want to say anything further. What should we not do as we serve survivors of abuse?
Well, we shouldn't preach. That's not what they need. They need a companion along the way who listens, walks with, has empathy, and things like that. And again, on the one hand, you have people who want to give them a verse and have them have enough faith and forget what's behind and press on and all those things. And we do that because we think that's the right thing to say. It's not. All those things are true, but they're not helpful. The other reason that we do that is because we're really uncomfortable listening to these things, which we should be. So we want to fix it. We want it to stop. So we take verses which are full of truth, and we cram them into a situation, and the result is supposed to be just add water and everything will be fine. And it doesn't work like that with human beings, with all kinds of things, let alone things like abuse. So if you find yourself preaching, you're not taking care of the victim, you're taking care of yourself. It's a long, slow, repetitive, hard process, and if it isn't, you're not doing it. You will also meet victims, and I've had this happen in my office, who will come in and they will say, I'm a believer and I know Jesus has healed me and all these wonderful things, and every once in a while it still comes up and I don't know what to do, but he's wonderful. And I'm thinking, well, you haven't even met your own story yet, because you ought to be wondering where the heck he was. That's normal. So people often for themselves use truths that are true, that we love and they love, but they don't fit, but they keep saying them over and over again in hopes that it'll make it fit. So, you know, then I say, okay, I believe you, and you're right, he is all those things. Can you tell me what it was like before you knew that?
You mentioned the woman leader who began to reference abuse in her talks. People are coming out of the woodwork. What do I do now? What was your answer, and what can we do now?
Well, the answer is some of what I've just said. Study, learn, read, listen. The other thing you can do is begin to talk to people who have abuse histories that you know of. Let's assume you know some, who are not flat out on the road because they can hardly stand up, but perhaps have been in counseling for a while, they're in a different place or whatever, and say to them, what would have helped you back then? Let them teach you. They've been teaching me for decades. They've been teaching me about what churches can do and what they shouldn't do and how they're not doing it right or when they are doing it right. They are your teachers. And so you don't want to have a group of helpers to help women who are experiencing domestic abuse, and nobody in your group has a clue personally what that's like. You also don't want it to only be people who have personal experience. But you want them to inform. That's true about male leaders, too. If you have to respond to a domestic abuse situation as elders or pastors or whatever, you need to talk to people who've lived through it. Not just the person in front of you. What would have been helpful to you if the male leaders in the church where you were when this happened did helpful, healing things? And learn.
What is your opinion of church leaders requiring documentation from a victim of abuse in order to gain approval from church leaders to move forward in separation or divorce?
Sometimes things are better left unsaid.
Okay.
No, I'm going to answer it. I just have to think, how to do that not with my original answer.
What is your opinion of church leaders requiring documentation from a victim of abuse in order to gain approval to move forward in separation and divorce?
Well, I don't exactly know what documentation means, but it probably means something other than her words. It probably means somebody was there when it happened and watched it and will sign off on it. Or it means there are physical marks somewhere that somebody can see or something like that. What that completely ignores is what part of what we talked about today, which is the level of tremendous deception that is part of being an abuser. So the woman who died that I told you about, who was killed, she didn't die, she was killed, they never saw any of her wounds. He bit her, he beat her, he bruised her, and he made sure none of it ever showed from wherever. She always wore long sleeves. I knew a woman years ago who used to come to our church. Turtlenecks, long sleeves. It's August, the air conditioning isn't working. I'm like, what the heck is that about? Years later, she came to my office. She was covering up terrible bruises. It's done on purpose that way. But sometimes there aren't bruises. I mean, there's no broken bones or bruises when you are emotionally and verbally abusive for 10 years. So how are you going to document that? And I'm puzzled by why, if a woman comes and says, this person is doing these things to me, we don't say it's credible. I mean, is this somebody who's come and lied to you the last 12 years? I mean, that would be a problem, right? But we assume it's not credible. So then it has to be proved. I don't understand that. If somebody came to you and said, there's a man outside the door who has a gun on my head, and if I tell you the truth, he's going to shoot me, you would probably get down behind your desk. You would give it credibility. We just think it's not possible. It's way possible. So the requiring of document, I think it's like, you know, somebody raped me. Well, did you have a witness? Well, usually rapists don't bring witnesses. So there's a mindset there that is completely erroneous and does terrible damage to victims, because they have no understanding. And it is always interesting to me to watch how little the church understands about deception. I mean, it's not like it's not in the scriptures. You know, if I can't even understand my own levels of deception, how the heck am I going to understand yours? And so we assume goodness. Actually, that's the wrong assumption. So you take the words, you have empathy and say how sad you are that that happened. You find people to walk alongside. You get them to professional help. You have to call the police. If it's a child, you do the mandated reporting, whatever. But you assume it's true. It's not your job to figure it out. And they don't have to come in and say, well, yes, I have a bruise here and I have a bruise here and I have a bruise here. Well, how do I know he did that? That's not how you do it. That was the nice answer.
Is it okay to ask someone if they have been abused?
This is another good psychologist answer, yes and no. I wouldn't do it that way. First of all, most people don't tell. So if you have a relationship where somebody's talking about struggles and things like that, and you ask them about their history, tell me about growing up, do you ever have an experience of abuse anywhere in your life? It's a general question. Many of them will say no and come back 6 months later and say, you know that question you asked me? Yes. And I've had clients who come to me and see me for a year and a half before they say, oh, by the way, my father had sex with me for 5 years. So they're afraid to tell. They don't think they'll be credible. Back to the other question. They have shame, which is not theirs. It's the perpetrator's, but they think it's theirs. So if you ask that straight out question, they'll just disappear inside themselves. They won't tell you the truth. So what you do, it's like the woman who called me. You know, you find a way to put it in the room without putting the focus on them. It's an invitation. You know, if this ever happened, I know it's a category and we could talk about it. That's all you're doing.
What is a godly, appropriate response for a victim of clergy abuse toward her abuser, both privately and publicly?
Well, the other psychologist's response is I have like 6 sessions worth of questions to ask first. because I don't know anything. In other words, the first thing that I would say is somebody needs to know the truth. I don't know who knows the truth. And I'm hoping if you are a victim of clergy sexual abuse, you're still not hanging out at the same church, because it's not safe. So, unfortunately, it depends. You should be angry. God is angry. He hates it. It was evil. He hates evil. That's not wrong. It's obviously destructive in your life. It's destructive in his life. And if it's not been dealt with correctly, it's destructive in the entire church's life. So there has to be truth. There has to be protection for you and all of those things. When people ask that question, they also want to know about forgiving, which is a whole huge area that, you know, we can't figure out today. But what I will say is this: forgiveness of atrocious things takes a really, really, really long time, and we have to do it 1,000 times. You don't just forgive somebody and go on. Every time it comes back up in your head, you have to do it again. It can be exhausting, frankly. And so we have this sort of idea, you know, it happens all the time with women who are in domestic abuse situations. They come in, they tell the pastor, and they say, okay, you need to go home, you need to do these things, you need to be more loving so he won't beat you, and you need to forgive him. He hasn't even stopped, and she needs to forgive him. That's actually not a good thing to do. It sets her up for more harm. So we have to be careful, because everything that we say has to take into account the reality of what happened and how it affected the perpetrator and the people around the perpetrator and the victim and all the other people. So you can't answer that question in like a way for everybody.
What is your first step in counseling someone whose life experience is so vastly different than your own, and whose experience of trauma is beyond your scope of understanding? Where do you begin?
I become the student. You know, it's this, you know, I travel all over the world and I go to these cultures, and so I read books galore before I go, and I talk to people who are from that culture if I can, and I ask them for the history. And when I went to Romania the first time years ago, you know, I had a psychologist there send me articles. And what did I learn about communism and Ceausescu and the children who live in the sewers even today and all that kind of stuff? I wouldn't have known how to process the things that I was hearing if I didn't know all that. I do the same thing with people. I mean, they don't have articles on themselves, usually. Some of them do. But the point is, I want first to be the student of whoever's in front of me. Teach me about you. Not just the facts of your life, though that's usually where people start because it's not quite so threatening, but what it's like to be you inside. You know, when your daddy went to Afghanistan and came home with no legs, what's that been like? I never had a daddy with no legs. I had a daddy whose legs didn't work, but he had legs. So I want to know inside the experience of who they are, who the I am is. And then I also want to know how other people responded to them. You know, when you told somebody you were being sexually abused by your uncle, what happened? What was it like? Who said what? How did it feel? What did you want to do? It takes a long time to learn what it's like to be another person in another culture. It takes a long time to learn what it's like to be another person in these situations, which frankly is another culture from the one I know. I didn't grow up in the culture of abuse. I work with people who have grown up in the culture of abuse for the last 5 generations. So I have to be their student. That's our first task is not to tell them things. Our first task is to be their student and learn from them and sit at their feet.
Okay, here are a couple questions regarding the responsibility of men's groups and elders and people like that, men.
People like that.
Yeah. sorry, I'm trying to summarize. Regarding the responsibility of men in leadership and in men's groups for confrontation and accountability for abusive men, these questions are from women. What can be done when these men don't want to confront? or hold accountable, but maybe we can expand it a bit to help men to know how to do that.
Part of that goes back to what I said before. The first thing the men have to do is give credibility to the woman. Does that mean she said everything 100% perfectly right? Probably not. Most of us don't. Plus, if she's being abused on a regular basis, she's probably not thinking very clearly. She's probably telling you less than the truth. She's afraid. She's afraid he's going to find out. She's afraid you're not going to listen. So when you come up against sexual abuse, rape, sexual harassment, domestic abuse of any kind, I would bring somebody else into the loop. They didn't teach you that in seminary. You don't know what to do. It's okay that you don't know what to do, but it's not okay to think you do and hurt people. So you need to have, if you're a pastor or elders, you need to have a list of people that you know in your area who do work with trauma and abuse, that you know love God and are safe for people and actually know something about those fields, which is not every counselor, just for the record. You know, people have specialties. So that person needs to be brought in, not only for the sake of this person, whether it's the abuser or the victim, but to educate you about this is what it's like to be a victim, this is what it's like to be an abuser, these are the things you need to do, these are the people you need to call, these are the services available, all of those things. You should not walk through such things that are so dangerous and damaging to human souls without assistance. It's frankly arrogant.
How does a person regain her identity after experiencing a long list of personal traumas and abuse? So you read this excruciating list of what
Yes.
this woman suffered.
She does not ever regain her identity. It's not possible. That's like saying after a semi runs over me and mutilates my legs, how do I get my legs walking again? It isn't going to happen. The question is, what is available to her over time as a new identity, which may have terrible damage in its history and terrible traumas and all kinds of suffering, but as that work is done and the story is told and some healing begins to occur, one of the greatest joys of the work I've done has been with some of the most broken people I've seen who didn't have any idea they were smart. They didn't have any idea they could paint or sing or write. And you watch, it's like, you know, I had two sons, and I remember when they were tiny, tiny infants looking at each of them when they were born and thinking, this is a treasure chest, and I have no idea what's inside this person. Well, the same thing is true with my clients. Their treasure chest is somebody ran over, but the treasures are in there. So part of what you want to do is help them find what nobody helped them find before. And frankly, those things are often hugely helpful in their healing journey. I mean, somebody who's had no voice learns out they can actually write. Somebody who never had anything to sing about finds out they have a beautiful voice. And so those things become ways of expressing not only good, but the pain. So you don't regain, not in this world, but you do get pieces of it back that have been crushed, and you also get strengths. And listen to this carefully, because I do not want this to sound like I'm making it all better. I am not making it all better. But you do get strengths out of your suffering that you would not have had. I mean, my family did that when my father was sick for 32 years. I learned things and have strengths that have affected my profession profoundly. Do I wish he'd been healthy? Absolutely. Are there a lot of losses around those 32 years? Absolutely. But there are also strengths. And so there's a new identity where the treasures come and are expressed and grown in, and the strengths born of hard places are there. And then some of the things that were true. So maybe, you know, somebody was a little child and had a good life and they had a great sense of humor, and then they got abused at around age 10 or 12 and they lost that, and at 40 they find it in my office. So some of it gets regained, but you don't become who you should have been without it. Not in this ruined world. It doesn't mean what you become isn't beautiful. Doesn't have a lot to give. Doesn't give glory to God. And it doesn't mean you don't laugh and you don't enjoy things and you don't find things you can do and everything else. But regaining...
It is difficult to find a counselor that is qualified in abuse. How can you screen for that? I've experienced irreparable damage by marriage counselors.
Yes. This is one of the places where I have to monitor myself. Let's start with this. And I would like everybody who is in leadership in the church to hear this very clearly from me and everybody else in the room as well. If you are in a domestic abuse relationship, you do not need, nor should you have, marriage counseling. It is not safe. You can't do marriage building unless there's a marriage. And you can't talk to these people and do he said, she said, and then he goes home and beats her up for she said. It's not okay. So first of all, if you have domestic abuse and somebody refers you to a marriage counselor, that's not where you want to go. And they may think you're terrible and you don't think marriage is sacred and you're doing all the wrong things. You're not. So that's number one. Number two, yes, there are lots and lots of people out there who are counselors and who do all kinds of good things and don't know anything about trauma, or they've only seen one person who was traumatized, and I know this happens because I've heard about it. So somebody will call a counselor and say, I have trauma in my life, do you work with trauma? And the person will say yes, and what it turns out is, I talked to somebody once who had trauma and I thought it was interesting, so I'd like to practice some more. That's not what you want. So I tell people, you know, people call from around the country, I don't know how to find somebody. And, you know, I don't know people where they live or whatever. So I say, here's what you do. You ask them questions. Are you licensed? How long have you been practicing? What are your specialties? And if they don't list what you want, it's probably not one. If they say, I work with trauma, I want to know, what kind of traumas have you worked with? How long have you done that? What kind of training have you had? Because most graduate programs don't teach you in trauma. That's changing, but still they don't. So that means they've had to have trainings from other people around the country, you know, continuing ed, all kinds of things. Are there people who are known for their work with trauma whose thinking you follow? And if they're grumpy about your questions, no, go see them. They shouldn't be grumpy. You're going to entrust your life and the parts of you that are most wounded to somebody you don't know and pay them money and you don't get to ask questions? So, take care of yourselves that way.
This is a question about how we as church leaders can be aware of and sensitive to how our words impact abuse victims. Several months ago, one of our pastors said that he found a lot of freedom by thanking God for some difficult things in his life. He asked the congregation to think of the worst thing that had ever happened to them and thank God for it as they were coming to receive communion. I talked to our pastors about this. I asked them to think about the... I asked them to think about the impact of that statement on someone who'd been abused. There are theological truths that we hold dear, like the sovereignty of a good God over all things. How do we affirm these truths while still being careful about how we impact our congregations?
You know, that's like telling somebody who lived through the Nazi Holocaust on their way to the communion table to thank God for the Holocaust. God hates the Holocaust. You didn't thank God for things that are evil. What you thank him for is perhaps who he is, or what he's teaching you, or how he actually sustained your life when you ought to be dead, or whatever. But of course, there are many people who aren't even ready for that yet. problem is, which is why we're doing this today, the problem is that there aren't yet many church leaders who, that's why I told you the stories in the second talk. There are people out there who, if they hear the word father, they want to crawl under the pew and cry. Or there are other people who are so afraid of that word, they want to run out the door and they don't want to talk to anybody ever. But we don't know that. We think everybody's like us. It's a tad egocentric. Huh? So you have something like this. This person has no processing of the terrible damage of one of the most beautiful things in Christianity. He's used that to hurt somebody, and he doesn't get it. So what you do is what you did, which is say. Now, then you have somebody who will say, oh my gosh, I've never thought about that. I need to think about that. I'd be happy to teach you a little more, you can say. Or you have somebody who says, no, it's okay, this is a good thing to do. Well, that tells you something about that person. They don't have ears to hear. So you have to figure out what to do with that. You could go in and talk further and say, this troubled me when you did this. And here's a story, not mine, but somebody else's. Can you imagine what it would be like for somebody to say, and I've had clients who've had this said to them, I'm supposed to thank God that my father raped me when I was 4? I don't think so. If you keep going to people in leadership and you get no response, you have deaf leadership. So then you have to decide whether you want to follow people who are deaf or not. And I don't know the answer to that. Everybody will make a different, you know, your timing will be different, your thinking will be different, God will show you, whatever. But you need to see what the response is. You need to push again and again and again. And eventually you need to say, would that you have known the things that would make for your peace, and leave the temple. That's what Jesus did, weeping.
I have noticed that predators in the grooming process build up their victims, enjoying being the one to raise them up and invest in them before they tear them down. How can we avoid that power dynamic and still raise people up in the church?
This is a correct assumption about grooming. Groomers don't start out by doing bad things to people. I think I mentioned the Catholic priest case that I was involved in years ago, and he bought him suits and shoes and all that kind of stuff. If you have a particular adult in your church, or adolescent for that matter, who is spending a lot of time with one person that has less power over and over again and doing good things for them, I would have a problem with that. And they will say, what's the matter with you? I did this, and I did this, and I did this. The question is, why are you doing this with this one person who has way less power than you do? That's not okay. It's not okay. And part of what happens is the person who's getting all these good things, who probably is desperate for love and attention, is soaking it up like a sponge, and they get to the point where they will do anything for you. And anything is usually not a good idea. So that's not about affirming. It's not affirming people to do that. When you make yourself, or somebody makes themselves the person, that's not affirming people. Complimenting people, affirming their skills, their knowledge, their abilities, something they did with the church or the children or whatever. All those things are wonderful and good, and that's not grooming. But if it's a person with power and one other person, over and over again, that's a ding-ding. Or it could be two or three, but it's a focused thing. So you might, you know, you remember the youth pastor's story. You know, you might see a youth pastor who's giving special spiritual attention to this one needy child, or these two needy children, or whatever. There's something not okay with that. If nothing else, I'm not even saying somebody's calculating something, though they often are, but if nothing else, it's lopsided. You're not the only person who can help somebody. Do I get to quit soon?
Like two more?
Go ahead.
An abuse victim deserves compassion. At the same time, self-protective survival behaviors may develop, These behaviors may have the potential to actually harm others. As a therapist, how have you handled these situations?
Well, certainly people can have protective behaviors that harm either the self, like drugs or cutting or whatever, or others. I really don't do anything at the beginning with that. I mean, you need a close, faithful, safe relationship with somebody before you start poking at things. But I think part of the way I would approach it is not so much, you know, you really shouldn't do that, that's not good for people, is what are you hoping to accomplish when you do that? And what are you afraid of when you do that? So you can have empathy for the fear, and the fear will make perfect sense to you given the history of abuse. And you can even have empathy and understanding for the self-protection part of it and agree, actually, you're wise to protect yourself if you can. I suppose we could think about another way to do that that doesn't do quite have the same results. So sometimes somebody will use a lot of anger, for example, rage at people that can go off like a tinderbox. And all they're doing is trying to protect themselves because they got overwhelmed and all kinds of things are going on in their heads that nobody has any idea about. But rage doesn't usually help relationships. But you can find out why it's there, what its purpose is, what they want to happen, and then you can begin to say, well, how about we try this or that? And they will usually have some flexibility enough to do that. But if you go in and say that's a bad thing to do and you shouldn't be doing it, in their mind, you're saying don't protect yourself. And you'll be the next person they're mad at.
Okay, I think this is the last. As a survivor of clergy sexual abuse as an adult, I am feeling drawn to start using my voice to make a difference. How do I best prepare to speak up, knowing many people will view what happened to me as an affair and shame and blame me? My voice matters. How do you suggest I ready myself?
One of the things I often will say to victims or survivors of abuse, almost every single one I've ever seen wants people to know something about what they've learned and what it did to them and things like that. They want to give back. It's a wonderful thing. It's a redemptive piece. It usually isn't done by telling your story. It's usually done by drawing from your story and using the elements, the principles, all of the things that you've learned to educate other people. Because and it's not that somebody isn't ever called to tell their story. That's not true. I'm not saying that. But if you just say, this is my story, first of all, people don't want it to be true. Because they don't want to think clergy will ever hurt anybody, because then they don't know what to do, right? Secondly, they'll think you made it up. Thirdly, they'll think what you're afraid they'll think, which is you had an affair and you were seductive in some way and the poor guy. You know, there's all kinds of things that they'll think. So what happens then is you become the enemy because of your story, which is not what you want to happen. So rather than saying, this is what happened to me, I find with victims who are ready to start speaking into systems or whatever, let's look at it together and figure out some of the things that you learned that are applicable to other places. So, you know, sometimes bad things happen to people and we want to blame them. And it makes us feel better because then we think if we don't do those things, it'll never happen to us. So it's a kind of selfish interpretation, right? But sometimes bad things happen to really grown-up people, and it isn't their fault. Have you ever thought of that? So you end up educating in a broader sense rather than, here's my story. And then somewhere you find trusting people down the road and say, well, the reason I know these things is because I do have a story. But then you tell them because you trust them. They've shown themselves over time as you've done the other teaching and educating.
Okay, you wanted to have some final words.
Yes. This is about all she wrote, folks. I want to close with two poems that mean a great deal to me, and I'm using them because they capture the essence of today. They've been themes, if you've listened, and I want you to hear them. The first one is from by George Herbert. And it's a poem called The Bag. It's only two stanzas of that poem. But you think about power, power to bless, God in the flesh, whatever. And listen, here's what he says. Hast thou not heard that my Lord Jesus died? Then let me tell thee a strange story. The God of power, as he did ride in his majestic robes of glory, resolved to alight, and so one day he did descend, undressing all the way. The stars his tire of light and rings obtained, the cloud his bow, the fire his spear, the sky his azure mantle gained. And when they asked what he would wear, he smiled and said as he did go, he had new clothes a-making here below. The Word made flesh. The second one is written by Amy Carmichael, who was a missionary to India for decades, who wrote many books, and she worked with abused and trafficked children who were trafficked into the Hindu temples. She rescued them and created a safe environment for them in days when nobody even knew such things existed, and they didn't really want her to write home to people who were supporting her about what she was doing because everybody would not believe her and so forth. So her readings have meant a great deal to me over the years, particularly in the early years when people didn't believe what I was hearing. And this is a poem that I read at a conference in New York City very shortly after Ground Zero. I had been on Ground Zero all night and then spoke the next day at this conference and read this. And in this poem, she is calling us to let Calvary, the killing tree, elucidate our lives. And here's what she says. Yet listen now. Oh, listen to the wandering olive trees and the white moon that looked between the leaves, and the gentle earth that shuddered as she felt great drops of blood. All torturing questions cease in him who girds his soul to listen there. There, only there, can we take heart to hope. For all lost lambs, aye, even for ravening wolves. Oh, there are things done in the world today would root up faith but for Gethsemane. For Calvary interprets human life. No path of pain, but there we meet our Lord. And all the strain and terror and strife die down like waves before his peaceful word. And nowhere but beside the awful cross, and where the olives grow along the hill, can we accept the unexplained, the loss, the crushing agony, and hold us still. And nowhere is that clearer vision given, which pierces a bewildering providence and opens windows upon highest heaven, but where we see suffering omnipotence. Thank you. It has been an honor to be here with you today.